Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dan Ashley, news anchor of ABC 7 Television in San Francisco, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and proud to be your moderator for today's program. It is my pleasure to introduce our special guest, Nancy L. Cohen, historian and author of the new book, Breakthrough: The Making of America's First Woman President. With Election Day just a short time away now, Nancy Cohen, a frequent commentator on women's political leadership, has interviewed 125 elected officials and strategists of both parties to assess the history of women's experience in politics, the changing political climate, and the current prospects for Hillary Clinton to win the country's highest elective office. Nancy is author of four books, including the widely acclaimed Delirium, The Politics of Sex in America, and The Reconstruction of American Liberalism. Her writing on American politics has appeared in The Guardian, The Los Angeles Times, The New Republic, and Rolling Stone. Currently, Nancy serves as a commissioner on the Los Angeles County Commission for Women and an elected executive board member of the Association of California Commissions for Women. She has taught politics and history at Occidental College, UCLA, Cal State Long Beach, and holds a PhD from Columbia University. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Nancy L. Cohen.
Thank you.
Nancy, nice to be with you.
Great to be here, Dan. Thank you all for coming.
You'll probably agree that I have been pleasantly surprised by the civil and dignified nature of this campaign. Wow, what a show we are getting.
Well, thank God we've got when America needs to be rescued, count on women to stand up and save the country.
It's really a fascinating time. We've never really seen anything quite like this in terms of the tone and the spectacle, not at least in modern times.
Absolutely. You know, as a historian who started off writing about 19th century American history, you know, a political junkie who's followed every presidential election since I've, you know, been conscious, no, we have never seen this. But, you know, it wasn't inevitable that we would have this level of misogyny confronting the first woman to be a nominee of a major party. And that's what I think is really funny. You know, it's almost like the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are operating in parallel universes, right? So they threw up Donald Trump, but it could have easily been a normal Republican like Jeb Bush or
Ed Carter. He was a speaker here at the Commonwealth Club mm-hmm. with me, and he was riding high for a time.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, and we would not have seen this degradation of the political dialogue had it been a normal Republican. So I think we want to, you know, assess what's going on right now, but also look ahead to what it's going to be like on November 9th after we have elected our first woman president.
Well, Nancy, in some ways, in many ways, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are two sides of the same coin in that they reflected a frustration among many people in the electorate regarding politics as usual and the traditional candidate. Donald Trump ended up coming out on top for the Republican Party. Bernie Sanders did not in the race against Hillary Clinton. But really, in a lot of ways, they reflect, would you agree, the same sort of frustration that voters feel.
That's a really interesting observation. I'm not sure if I'm kind of ready to go there with
Why?
You. I think I think they're really different in kind, right? The kinds of racism, xenophobia, authoritarian tendencies. Republican Party has, in the last several years, just, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod at birtherism, at this kind of stuff. So they kind of created the conditions for Trump to rise up. If you look at a lot of the polling, right, it isn't necessarily that Trump's strongest supporters are economically strapped. There's a lot of interesting polling and statistical regressions that race and gender, a feeling that white men have lost privilege, is actually driving the vote, isn't just kind of a sideline on it.
How does that explain Bernie Sanders? Go back to the primaries,
right,
not where we are now, because
right,
Bernie Sanders in a normal year would not have had such a successful run against such a powerful and established opponent in Hillary Clinton.
Right, right. So
Nor would Donald Trump,
right,
normally.
So I think for Sanders, there is a lot of economic frustration in the country, particularly among young people, and the Democratic Party has moved to the left over the last, 10 years, 15 years since Hillary Clinton emerged on the stage. There was an opening for Sanders in part because no other Democrats wanted to take her on. So he was able to consolidate a lot of the, the leftist sentiment, we think the Clintons are too centrist, we are concerned about whether the Clintons are trustworthy. He had a kind of authenticity that, frankly, Hillary Clinton lacks on the campaign trail. He didn't have much of a record for people to throw things at him. So he was a good messenger for the discontent on the Democratic side. People, particularly who've grown up with the first African American president, really don't know anything but that. So I also think what is interesting about, and this kind of brings it back to gender a little bit, I find it very ironic that we get complaints about the establishment really for the first time that the likely president is going to be a woman. So I do think there's some deeper unconscious kinds of resistance to a woman president, even though I think we are absolutely ready to elect a woman president, and I don't think sexism stops women from winning elections.
Sure. 8 years ago, would you say that there was a similar sentiment regarding the first African-American president, some pushback among some?
That's what's so fascinating, and this is why I go back to the Republican Party owns this. Colin Powell had this expression, you break it, you own it, to refer to, foolish excursions abroad. And in the 2008 campaign, when Sarah Palin did start, feeding the audiences, the birtherism, the racism stuff, the Obama is a Muslim, which was, pure racism, John McCain said no. John McCain put the brakes on that. And that's what political leaders used to do and should do. So it's Trump, the Republican Party gave permission for people to express this openly. And then Trump has, brilliant showman that he is, right? Organized it to say, no, not only is it okay if you say it, but this is the way you should feel. It's going to take a lot to get our country back to where we can start having a civil conversation and accept that this is a diverse country and that all people should be represented in some way. So that's where I think that had the, 14, 16 other Republican candidates shown some spine, showed less selfishness about being nominated themselves, the Republican Party could have put a stop to Donald Trump. So ironically, the fact that Trump rose because there were too many Republicans and Sanders rose because there were no other viable Democrats.
It's an interesting point. And Donald Trump was able to cut through all of that noise, so many contenders, precisely because he is and was a showman and understood how to grab the headlines and dominate the conversation, which is what he did against so many Republican challengers. I've done a number of columns over the years and commentaries on what I've called the coarsening of America. You just mentioned you think it's going to be, and that's true in a lot of walks, aspects of our lives, it seems mm-hmm. to me. Yeah. We're a little bit ruder than we used to be, mm-hmm. a little bit more crass. What we watch and see is a little bit more rough. It's certainly the case in politics, and that's been developing over the last couple of decades, really. Do you think will the pendulum swing back eventually? Or where do we go from here in terms of the nature and tone of the kinds of campaigns we're seeing? And it's not just at the presidential level. You see pretty nasty campaigns at the congressional, even local races these days.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've been thinking a lot about this, and I've been talking on college campuses in the heartland, so-called, and a lot of young women and young men are asking these questions. What do we do now? I think it's really challenging. I do think that the results of the presidential election are going to make a big difference in where we go from now. And I really do feel that if Hillary Clinton gets an overwhelming majority of the vote, then the Republicans are going to have an incentive to work with her, right? And if she, you know, if it's a close election, I think we're going to see the continuation of the, you know, opposition, the obstructionism that Obama faced over 8 years. But, you know, in talking to Republican women for this book, a lot of them have a great deal of respect for Hillary Clinton. They say, you know, she is absolutely able to cross the aisle and work together, you know, respectfully with us. We did legislation together on, you know, she worked with the people who led the impeachment against her husband. So I think that her deep experience and her resilience and also the particular makeup of her character it's good that there's someone like this who's on the cusp of the presidency.
Now let me interrupt you, Nancy, because you say makeup of her character. That's a big issue in this campaign because there are a lot of people who question her character and mm-hmm. her honesty. And do you think she will get the kind of cooperation that you are suggesting, given the polarizing nature of her personality and her public image?
So let's take that in two parts, the Hillary question. First, right, corrupt, untrustworthy, she's rigged the system, according to Republicans and according to Sanders during the primary, and a lot of his young supporters still perhaps feel this way. I think it's important to remember how long she's been in the public eye. She has been kind of the advance guard for American womanhood. Right? When women in the first year of the women in 1992 got into the Senate, you know, the senators kind of put their heads down and started working together, the Republicans and the Democrats. I have some, you know, really wonderful stories about that in the book, about them working together. But there were a lot of people that were really angry that Clinton had won the presidency, then she runs health care reform. So she's kind of, she absorbed so much of the explicit self-defined anti-feminist backlash of the 90s. You know, so she brings that with it. She and Bill bring the conflicts in the Southern Democratic Party back from the 60s and 70s over civil rights and segregation. So, you know, she has been a magnet for lots of charges about what she has done, most of them fully litigated and disproved. Now, she is also, because of that, I think, become, you know, very defensive, and that's on top of having a kind of guarded personality that comes out of her Methodism, I think. So that combination makes it look like she's hiding something, and she has made certain decisions.
But she has been hiding things. In truth, I mean, there's a number of instances. The emails are one, and the server. I mean, she's not blameless in all of this.
I am
not
saying she
Nancy?
Is blameless.
Yeah. There are other women in politics who have not drawn the same level of vitriol. Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, even Geraldine Ferraro when she ran for president.
Well, Barbara Boxer attracted quite a lot of attacks from Carly Fiorina.
Well, that's true. But not to this scale, I don't think.
Right. Well, I think it's, you know, the higher you ascend on the ladder, the more you're going to draw it out. I think it will. I do think that she's taken so much of it that she's absorbed it for a lot of women coming up in the future.
Do you think it will be easier for women in the future?
Absolutely.
You know, President Obama, when he ran on the promise of hope and change, and there was so much optimism, and he had hoped to change the tone in Washington, and he didn't, but one can't blame him for that. It didn't change. It maybe even became more hostile. Are you optimistic at all that the tone can change with Hillary Clinton as the first woman president, or do you expect more of the same division between the parties? Nasty division. There will always be division, of course, but real ugly division.
It is not going to go away because many of the Republican congressional representatives and senators who were elected in very red districts, they have a personal interest in keeping the conflict alive. So this is where I do think it's going to depend on the nature of the vote. Do Democrats retake the Senate? And by how many seats, you know, that will put Senate Republicans back on, okay, maybe we should do something. So it's going to take place at the level of policy and politics. I don't know this for a fact. I haven't talked to anybody inside, but I can assume that Hillary's team is preparing for absolute resistance. I think we don't know whether part of Trump's plan is to create a new right-wing media conglomerate with Steve Bannon and Breitbart at the head of it. And that would really keep things going, and we'll have to, you know, it's going to happen on the cultural level, it's going to happen on the political level. I will say that Obama believed a little bit too much of the rhetoric of his campaign, and he kind of took his foot off the gas in the first few months, thinking that his landslide would compel Republicans to go along with him. The advantage of Hillary's 20, 30 years in the public spotlight is
less naive about that.
Yes.
The Republican Party, with this recent tape that has come out regarding Donald Trump, and so many in the party, Paul Ryan and others, distancing themselves, is pretty significant as they try now to make sure they don't lose too much ground in the House and the Senate. Is the Republican Party in free fall? Is it as bad as it may appear for the party?
Yeah, it's really bad. But I think it's really bad, and, you know, Republicans are either, you know, going to have to put it back together themselves. You know, good luck to them. I do believe America needs a strong two-party system, and I hope they can do it. But for those of us who aren't Republicans, independents, Democrats, progressives, liberals, feminists, it's critical that we get this right, right? I mean, Donald Trump and his Republican enablers are giving us a masterclass in the varieties of 21st century sexism. But most of that sexism is not predatory misogyny that Trump has expressed.
What is it? Define it.
I think there's a lot of variety. So I think there's a lot of kind of everyday sexism from older people, mostly men, to the point where they tell Clinton to smile more when she speaks, or that she's not energetic enough, or she's too shrill. I mean, that comes from the very gendered nature of the presidential election. We've always had men on the stage, and we judge them by a measuring stick that's calibrated to the male body and the male voice. So that's one. And I think that stuff, you know, women don't have patience for it. I think many of the men who are doing it realize what it sounds like once women call them. I expect a lot of that stuff to go away, and I think a lot of that's harmless.
Are you referring to this double, what many would call a double standard, that if a man is tough and aggressive. He is being a leader and he's assertive. And if a woman does it, she's being something else.
Yeah. I am referring to that. And I actually, as I write in the book, I don't really think that women running for executive office face this double bind anymore. You still hear a lot of comments about this, but it's not like anybody's basing their votes, right, on this. Voters expect a president, man or woman, to be strong. They expect her or him to be likable. And men and women are really judged by similar standards on this. So I think a lot of this is just noise that it will, you know, be lovely to see it disproved. I think the more significant problem of, you know, that falls into this big category of sexism is what I would call the paternalism that comes particularly out of the Republican religious right. And you hear it as like, you know, the like smelling salts. Oh, I have daughters. I have a wife. How could you say this about them? Right? I mean, you're a human being. How could you say this about anyone? How can you not be offended about this statement just because you are a human being and threatening someone with assault is wrong? And the most important part of the Republican base and the part that is still sticking with Donald Trump is a religious right that believes in a literal reading of the Christian Bible that says, in fact, women are not equal. Women have a God-given role to be subordinate to their husbands. So I do think...
Do you really believe, Nancy, in this day and age that that's a dominant thought?
No, I think it's a very small minority of the country.
Then who cares if it's a small
minority? It's a very powerful part of the Republican base. And it is significant that the one group that's really sticking with Trump are the evangelicals, the religious right, and they have made a deal with the devil because Donald Trump will appoint a Supreme Court that will overturn Roe v. Wade, and although we don't talk about it, will also overturn the right to same-sex marriage. Be assured that if the Republicans can appoint, you know, where the vacancy now and the 2 to 3 seats additional that will come up in this presidency, that those rights will be gone. And that is the most important thing.
Let me play devil's advocate. Is that fear-mongering, though? Because we've heard that about Roe v. Wade for decades, and it's been the law of the land for a long time.
Oh, no,
and
it's not fear-mongering at all.
People have said that they were going to challenge it successfully for a long time, and it hasn't really happened. Hasn't that question been decided?
Absolutely not, okay. Because in the states since 2010, I'm losing count, but last year when I did the count, it was over 300 laws had been passed at the state level restricting women's access to abortion and birth control. You know, the defunding Planned Parenthood, the defunding Title X, you know, this was kind of a subject of my last book that I don't want to, like, keep, you know, it's kind of like Groundhog Day almost, but yes, this is absolutely where they are, and a lot of the laws passed, a lot of the governors who have signed these bills, for example, Mike Pence, the vice presidential running mate, have said explicitly that these laws were signed to set up a challenge to Roe v. Wade.
Okay, so you believe it's a very real threat.
An absolute guarantee that it's gone if a Republican can appoint 2 more Supreme Court justices.
Okay. Nancy, this is from a member of the audience. Do you see the polarizing presidential race this year as an indicator that perhaps a two-party system isn't a sustainable model anymore? Someone like Bernie Sanders and others who may run outside the two-party system in years to come. Do you think the two-party, you just mentioned that you believe the two-party system is important. Is it sustainable?
It has to be sustainable. So this is where I go back to my, you know, like I put on my political science hat. So my early work in history was on the Civil War era, you know, when the Republican Party was a third party. And we also had a civil war when they won election. That's not a coincidence between that. So there's certain institutional reasons that make it not only impossible, but also a little risky to support third parties. And, you know, this is just wonky political science stuff. We have winner-take-all elections. We have single-member districts. Most countries that have more parties, even if it isn't a parliamentary system per se, they have proportional representation. So if you get 50% in a, you know, House election and another party gets 40% and another party gets 10% and there are 10 seats, one party gets 5, the other gets 4, and the third gets 1. In the United States, and this is particularly true of the presidential election, which is like a, you know, one large single-member district, essentially, to support a third-party candidate is always to take votes away from the other party that is more similar to yours. I have looked at a lot of the research. It is absolutely clear that Gore would have been president if Nader hadn't been in the race. Political scientists have crunched these numbers all kinds of ways.
So he really was the spoiler.
He was the spoiler. Nader was the spoiler, and there's a threat of, I think, less so after the recent revelations of Trump on tape and on video talking about assaulting women, but there is the possibility of Johnson or Stein being a spoiler.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program. Our guest is historian and author Nancy L. Cohen, who is discussing whether America is really ready to elect a woman president. Her new book, Breakthrough, The Making of America's First Woman President. I'm Dan Ashley of ABC 7 News in San Francisco. You can find video of club programs on the club's YouTube channel. Be sure to also catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter. We're glad you're with us discussing these issues, Nancy. Really interesting stuff. I want to turn our attention directly to your book in a few moments, but the broad question raised in your book, is America ready to elect its first female president? The answer seems clearly yes.
The answer seems clearly yes. And I'll tell the story about how I came to write this book. When Obama was running for election in 2008, my youngest daughter, who was about 9 at the time, said to me, "How many women have been presidents of the United States?" Like, I'm a failure. I'm a historian, and she doesn't know this. But, you know, if you think about it, it just shows kind of the difference in the, you know, generation women. I don't know whether we're at under 30, under 35, under 40 now. It's like, of course America should have elected a woman president already. More than 50 nations have elected a woman president. You know, we're behind Kosovo and Bangladesh on this score. So after 2012, and I had another book out, as you know, that was really focused on women in the election, and women did win the election, the 2012 election for Obama, I thought, okay, what's next? What's next? And you know, as you know, you're thinking about what your next project is as an author. I thought, oh, of course. We're probably going to have a woman running for president. It's likely to be Hillary. I was sure some of the other Democratic women would jump in if it wasn't Hillary. I expected Republican women to jump in. You know, there are
and
a lot
they did,
of,
early for your reign.
She was, but I expected the ones who have been elected to office to jump in.
Okay.
So,
Your timing was impeccable, Nancy.
Well, you know, there were moments over the last 6 months where, you know, I just wanted to hide the subtitle and wondering if this is going to, you know, have to go to the, you know, remainder bin at the Strand bookstore.
Well, I don't think that's the case. Nancy, this is from a member of the audience. J. Newton Small of Time Magazine spoke at the Commonwealth Club a few months ago, great program, about her book, Broad Influence. One premise of hers was that we often need to see critical mass of women in positions of power before they are seen as powerful. Yet Hillary Clinton seems to have risen nearly to the top as a unique individual, not as one of a group of powerful women. Does the sheer number of female politicians help explain the support of Hillary Clinton now? Interesting question.
Great question. Great question. So I think one of the unknown parts of Hillary's history is that she has absolutely been at the center of a number of women's networks. And this was one of the things that was so striking to me when I was doing the research for Breakthrough is, you know, we think about Shirley Chisholm, we think about Margaret Chase Smith, we think about Geraldine Ferraro as like, so they've paved the way for a woman president. And I don't think that's the case. I think they're admirable. I think we should celebrate them. But what has really paved the way is women seeing when they wanted to come into politics that the old boys club wasn't rolling out the red carpet. So women did it for themselves. They built fundraising networks. They built lobbying organizations. They built organizations to train women to run for office. Barbara Mikulski, the first Democratic woman senator, alone there, could do nothing about, say, the Clarence Thomas hearings because she was one of two senators. When all the women came in, she's like, okay, here's your briefing book. Here's how you do it. And remember, Hillary was a senator. So she worked with those women senators when she was first lady, and then she was a junior member of this group in the 2000s. So she also has a very tight circle of women around her who are policy wonks. Mm. And so I guess I would say, you know, the answer to this, you know, behind all great women are women. We owe the fact that we have so many women in office and we have a woman nominee of a major party because of women's movements.
Nancy, back us up 8 years. What paved the way for Barack Obama's presidency then?
Barack Obama, like Bill Clinton, is an unbelievably talented retail politician and a brilliant man and, you know, great character. So he had, he actually rose through your kind of standard old boys networks. Yes, he was African American. I do want to point out that at this moment, the majority of the Democratic caucus is made up of white women, women of color, and men of color. White men are a minority in the Democratic caucus. So I think Obama, you know, by his incredible talents, rose, but he really didn't.
But he rose very quickly. He hadn't been around that long as a politician.
I know, but that at that particular moment, that wasn't that unusual. You know, everybody said, okay, someone who wants to run from the Senate, it can't be there too long to amass a record.
I guess what I'm asking is, you know, if Hillary Clinton rose with the help and support of a network of women, really, that wasn't the case for Barack Obama. It wasn't a network of African-American men or politicians.
It was traditional
politics, is what you're saying?
Yes, but, you know, David Axelrod was one of the leading Democratic operatives, consultants, campaign leaders. He had run a number of campaigns for white men, for president, and in Chicago. So I do, I think it is different.
Okay,
interesting. For women.
One of the things that you I think came out in the research in your book is that when there are female candidates on the ticket, they are highly electable. There's not a resistance to putting them in office. There are just not as many female candidates as many would like to see.
Right. Right. So that's absolutely the case. I think in many cases, being a woman on a ticket is an advantage, not a disadvantage.
Interesting. Why?
There are a few things. If you're a woman who's never held office before, the research shows that people tend to assume that women are more outsiders. So the kind of anti-establishment outsider view, if you're looking at, you know, a house race or something local, the presumption is a woman isn't part of those old networks. And I think a big part of it is in the Democratic Party, we're pushing six out of 10 Democratic voters are women. 10 million more women than men voted in the 2012 election. So wherever, this is particularly true wherever, you know, so-called women's issues are activated, that a woman on the ticket does a little bit better than a man in the same, she can kind of take it, you know, and so I think this is useful in this particular moment,
sure,
that Hillary Clinton in her can embody the contrast to Trump more than, say, a man in the same situation could.
Nancy, if that's the case, what does that say about the place of women in our political and national life now? That seems quite encouraging, that it is not as bleak as perhaps it once was, or that some would say it is now. In other words, the glass ceiling isn't as difficult to break as it once was.
Absolutely. So despite all this ugly sexism and the nastiness of this election, I am really optimistic. I'm optimistic because the polling shows that the majority of Americans support gender equality. The majority of men support, you know, feminism with a small f. They wouldn't necessarily call themselves feminists. The research shows that people don't base their votes on gender bias, that they are concerned about party, about ideology, you know, about policy. I do think that this election is testing a little bit how many people are still driven by that old bias. I think it's a bit of a surprise. This part is a bit of a surprise to me. I still don't think it's enough to be a majority in America.
But so, the majority of people don't base their decisions or votes. That's men and women.
That's men and women. And you saw this in the last cycle. There were a lot of Republican women that won Senate races, right? So for the Republican Party, there is, you know, there is more traditionalism in the party, but a woman who can position herself as, you know, a strong mother and strong on defense and small government, there are many places where Republicans are eagerly looking for women to lift up so that they can say, look, our party isn't like this. And I am all in favor of this. I think it's a great development. And I do think one of the things we'll, you know, one of the ways the Republican Party is going to, you know, get off the Donald Trump train is by really looking for women candidates that they can lift up.
Fast forward, is it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? When do you think we won't think about these issues? I mean, we've had our first African-American president. One hopes that the second and the third we will barely notice. Same thing is true with women. When do you think we'll get to a point in this country where it simply doesn't matter? Are we close?
I think we're close. I think this election proves, you know, the for every movement forward, there is resistance. That resistance looks a little bit stronger than I think many of us thought it was. But it's useful to see it because I think we need to honestly look at what is this expression? What is this expressing? Is it about economic anxiety? Is it about cultural anxiety? Is it the coarsening of our debate and leaders not being leaders, mm-hmm, and putting a brake on that? I think there are lots of different ways that we can address this. I do think we're just, you know, 5 or 10 years away from, you know, any election is going to be, you're going to see multiple men and women who are white and of color running and contesting. And, you know, it'll be a little part of a stump speech in particular areas where they're speaking to their community. You know, one of the leaders.
But not a dominant factor.
Not a dominant thing. So what was most, one of the things that was most striking to me, one of the women who was kind of right at the head of second wave feminism, Eleanor Smeal, mm-hmm, said to me, well, of course it matters that we have a woman president. We talked about that. And she's like, but someday it's not going to matter. Right. And I'm trying to get to that day when it doesn't matter. And I agree with that.
You know, if you look back at professional sports, particularly in the 70s and even into the 80s, there was a lot of criticism about front office staff not being represented very well by African Americans. And we've come to a place now in most sports, it seems to me, where there's African American quarterbacks and coaches and front office personnel, and no one really talks about it and notices it anymore. They're hired and fired like anybody else, and it's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think we will get there in politics? In our lifetimes?
I do. And I think kind of this is where, back to that question about critical mass, this is where critical mass matters a little bit. You know, some of the, you know, women executives like Sheryl Sandberg have talked about this a lot, that there's so few women in leadership that they have to, you know, represent all women. So their slightest misstep, you know, is taken as a, you know, a hit on all women, on all women potential CEOs. And I think that's part of what Hillary Clinton has faced. And I do think so when you have enough people, right, these individuals get judged as individuals.
Okay. We're with Nancy L. Cohen, author of the new book, Breakthrough, The Making of America's First Woman President. Nancy, from the audience, I'm going to add to this, but let me read what the audience member asked. From your experience, what do voters fear most about having a woman president? Are fears justifiable or even realistic? And let me just tack onto that. Mm-hmm. It occurs to me that as we look around the world stage over many years, Angela Merkel in Germany, Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady of Great Britain, I don't know that there was, and correct me if I'm wrong or weigh in on this, I don't know that Americans viewed those women that they see in other countries leading their country as anything less than. They accepted them as leaders just as they would a male. Are we at that point in the United States where the attitudes of most people will be the same as if looking at Margaret Thatcher or Angela Merkel or any other female leader? And why don't we? Why wasn't it a big deal for us looking at Margaret Thatcher 25 years ago?
Yes, I do believe we are absolutely at this point where voters don't fear anything particularly about a woman president. The voters who fear things about Hillary, they fear them because she's a Clinton, not because she's a woman. And I think this is true, you know, you go down Senate, governor, et cetera. One of the interesting things I found is that it's almost like women for the last 20 years have been shadow boxing with these myths about voters' fears of women in leadership. You know, I kind of unraveled, went back to some of the original research that says, oh, voters don't believe that a woman has what it takes to be in executive office. Yeah, they'll vote for someone, you know, to be their representative in Congress because she doesn't have the ultimate authority. And I've seen over and over again from Hillary's campaign in 2008, from women that I watch, you know, just in Los Angeles, where I'm from, this fear that, oh, you know, I have to, you know, the walking the tightrope. I have to prove I'm tough. I can't be too tough. I have to be likable. You know, there's a whole cottage industry of consulting that has developed around teaching women how to run for office, and it's based on myths that I think expired in the 1990s. So it's one of the messages that I hope we can get across is that women running for office can approach it with more confidence. It's a gendered stage. But we saw this in Donald Trump, you know, talking about, you know, little Marco and, you know, low energy Jeb. Gender is just one of the go-to attacks right. in politics.
But you're suggesting that really any but a significant portion of any trepidation about Hillary Clinton is not because she's a woman, but because she's Hillary Clinton and there's some baggage there.
Yes. I mean, I do.
So it's not a sexist.
It's probably not a popular thing to say right now, but I don't think most of what Hillary has faced is because of sexism. I mean, there is a, you know, small minority, alt-right, vicious, predatory misogyny that we see in T-shirts at the rallies that really, you know, I'm not going to say this because this will air on public radio.
It's a family crowd here, Nancy. Yeah. And that certainly is always something that needs to be addressed, but there's always going to be some small minority in
yes.
anything. I mean, you know, we can't legislate away dumb behavior and stupid attitudes. But by and large, you really haven't heard a lot of criticism of her because she's a woman. although when Barack Obama ran for president, there was a lot of subtle racism directed to him. It was a different type
of resistance. Yes, but I mean, I think when Trump talks about her not having stamina and all the health, there's a lot of coded sexism, too, in exactly the same way that Obama faced the coding, oh, he's a Muslim. Oh, she doesn't have stamina. She's not healthy enough to be president. That wouldn't be the what they went to there. And I mean, it's interesting because you have this, you know, throwback to, you know, the worst of 1950s American sexism, like I can prey on anybody, women are just objects for me to take advantage of, you know, Trump. And it's kind of almost comical that he goes to these attacks. Hillary Clinton doesn't have stamina. I mean, please. You know, she's not healthy enough, right? So it does show that, like, whatever's operating in that little head of his is...
It's not that little.
Is, you know, doesn't...
It's not that little. As you look back now at this book, is there anything in it that you discovered that surprised you, that you didn't expect to find? I realize you approached it with a certain point of view, but is there anything that you didn't expect to come across?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways what we've been talking about, you know, about the question of sexism and how sexism influences election and whether women candidates are at a disadvantage. I went in, like most women who live in America, assuming that there are still cultural barriers to accepting women's full leadership. And that, yes, there was still a double standard. I thought it was probably not strong enough that she'd probably still be able to kind of, any woman would be able to inch her way over. But I was really struck by the most recent research on this that really, you know, as I've said a number of times, you know, women don't lose elections because of sexism. The other thing I will say is that what surprised me while I was doing the book is how many times I would tell people what I was writing, and so quickly they would go to, oh, I don't vote for just any woman. And so, of course, I would say, well, I don't vote for just any woman either, right? It's someone has to share my values and my interests. So one of the questions I really wanted to examine was, does it make a qualitative difference when you have a woman in a particular office as opposed to men? And I was struck at how strong the global research is on this question. It is absolutely unequivocal from the research that women in office prioritize the issues and concerns of women to a far greater degree than men do, and it's very rare for men to do it. So I think one of the biggest reasons to elect a woman president and elect women into other offices is that if we put women at the table of power, they're going to fix it. They're going to work to close all our remaining gender gaps. They're going to work to, you know, influence the culture so that the kinds of things that have been said in this election, people realize are not okay to say.
Don't you think most people realize that, though?
Yes, I think that one's. But I think the kinds of structural things that are holding women back, the fact that we're one of three countries in the world that do not guarantee paid maternity leave. The other two countries that don't do this are Papua New Guinea and Suriname. Okay? Every other advanced nation and every other nation guarantees paid maternity leave. Childcare, you know, sick days. Yes.
you mentioned Bangladesh earlier. We're behind there, too.
So I do think that if we want to kind of bring what I think are the majority values of gender equality into accord with how our society is structured, putting women there to kind of fix the policy will go a long way to do it.
They need to have a seat at the table in greater numbers. Yeah. From the audience, interesting question. Going back to Bernie Sanders for a moment, and the future, you talk about the strength of the two-party system and the need for the two-party mm-hmm. system. Had Bernie Sanders run as an independent rather than as a Democrat, would that have made a difference? Would he have been in a Ralph Nader spoiler role, potentially? for Hillary Clinton?
Yes, he would have. I think in part, though, the way he was able to gain traction was by running in a Democratic primary. You know, once he was able to generate the crowds, it gave him more media attention. The media does tend to, you know, the media knows that third-party independent candidates usually aren't going anywhere. So, right, he said, you know, there are reports that he knew this himself, that he decided that he would get more traction, more media coverage if he ran in the Democratic primary. So I think he, you know, it was an amazing campaign. He injected lots of important issues into the debate, and I think we got that debate because he ran as a Democrat. Right.
Well, and one of the things he certainly revealed, Barack Obama was very successful at it 8 years ago using social media and leveraging the power of youth. Bernie Sanders was brilliant at leveraging the college-age crowd and using social media to really propel his campaign and give it kind of the momentum that it had. Let's talk a little bit about the role of social media when it comes particularly to advancing female candidates, because social media is so popular among women. Women use Facebook in huge numbers, more than men do, and it's a very powerful tool, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
And young people as well.
Yes. And, you know, for good and ill, let's talk about the good part of it. I do think what was maybe the media will start paying a little bit more attention to those quiet...
Why did you look at me when you said that?
I'm sorry. I was talking...
I'm teasing.
Thank God. Okay. So, of course, you know, thank God that all of our journalists haven't been put in jail by Donald Trump and that we actually get these reports, right? Okay.
So. I agree with that.
But there is a way in which, you know, we're creatures of habit. So the press has covered presidential campaigns. It's like, okay, we can tell if a campaign is strong by are there a lot of people at a rally with someone on stage? And that is absolutely one way of gathering support. But it's not so, but most of the people at those rallies are men. Young women are, and, you know, those of us who are
now,
older
is that,
women.
Is that true at a Hillary Clinton rally? That's not true then.
No, it's not true, but her rallies are smaller. She's starting to have the bigger rallies. But a lot of her support was what I would call quiet enthusiasm. Mm. You know, I am a member of a private Facebook group called Bitches for Hillary, you know, bitches in the positive sense. So
is there a positive sense?
Yeah, it's like the kind of empowering, you know, where people were talking about, you know, God, right, how do I answer this? I'm being attacked, right? There was a lot of...
So it's this quiet sort of enthusiasm versus the Donald Trump rallies, which were rock concerts in terms of the number of people showing up.
Yeah, or, you know, Nuremberg rallies. I mean, however you want to look at it.
Well, and good line. But same thing with Barack Obama. He had these massive rallies, and it was clear that there was a lot of momentum. Donald Trump had these massive rallies. Other candidates in the Republican Party running for the nomination as well would have much...
Smaller
crowd. Yeah. So, of course, the media will gravitate to where there seems to be the most interest.
Yeah.
You're saying that really wasn't how Hillary Clinton
rose. No, and it's because she is she's much more comfortable by all accounts and by witnessing her in smaller groups where she can talk to people or, you know, go full on wonk. You know, there are many women who are incredibly charismatic public speakers. I think Hillary is amazingly qualified and experienced and resilient and will be a great president.
But it's not
one of her strengths is not charismatic public speaking. So, you know, maybe down the road as we're talking about these other women running, we'll see a woman presidential candidate who rallies women and men with these big, you know, public speeches. I do think that each year, social media becomes more important.
In terms of engaging women, but also young people?
Yeah. Yeah. Engaging, you know, getting people to feel like they're invested in the campaign.
From your perspective, the last couple of years, how have we engaged young people in this process? I know a lot of young people I talk to turned off by the mm-hmm. tone and the nature of this campaign on both sides. They just don't like it. They're not crazy about either candidate. They just don't like the process. And yet, social media appeals directly to them and makes gives them much greater voice.
Yes, I mean, absolutely, the young people that I've talked to are turned off by this. Most people who aren't political junkies are turned off by this. I really do feel, having followed politics closely since the 2012 election, seeing the massive defeat of Democrats in 2014, that a big part of the objective of Republican obstruction is to just demoralize people. To say, well, my vote doesn't matter because government can't do anything. So I don't know how we get around that. So I think young people have been particularly susceptible to this, particularly because they came in with the hope and change of Obama. It's really sad that we're in this breakthrough moment, we're in this potential transformation. And how much are we talking about this milestone for America of electing a woman president? This is an advance of democracy, but we've been drawn into the gutter with
this.
Well,
but should we be voting for Hillary Clinton simply because she's a woman? And initially, early in her campaign, she did play that card quite a bit, that women should rally behind her because she's a woman.
So I think there are three reasons to support women as women: style, substance, and symbolism. The evidence is strong that women have a more collaborative style. We've seen the women in Congress actually breaking the gridlock more often than men. Jane Newton Small broke one of the big stories about that. The substance I talked about, women are more likely to do things that we need done in policy. And then there's the kind of symbolism question. As you mentioned, women are more likely to be politically active if, as teenagers, they see women run for office.
But you're not suggesting people should vote for Hillary Clinton simply for symbolism because she's a woman and we should have a woman
president. No, I think first you look at her, you decide, do you agree with her? So if she was running against a normal Republican, you would look at her policies and you say, am I an independent Democrat or Republican? If I'm a Republican, am I moderate enough that I prefer Hillary Clinton because of her policies to, let's say, Jeb Bush? Okay, Jeb Bush is very extreme on the abortion question. I talked to another number of Republican women, like Kay Bailey Hutchinson, who said that she almost ran for president. But kind of George W. Bush blocked her, and the Bush family blocked her. She was definitely throwing some shade at Jeb when I talked to her. She said, I respect Hillary Clinton, but I wouldn't vote for her because I would want a woman who represents my idea of how you govern America, what your policies are. So if we were having a normal election, that's what we would be saying, and we would add to it, which I think Hillary was doing more often. It's like, and this is an important milestone. Now we are not in a normal election, right? And I do think, Democratic norms depend on this. So we really have transcended gender in this. But I think we can look forward to what's afterwards and think, well, what might she do uniquely because she's a woman? And I think that's important for us to talk about and own.
What might she do uniquely, and what do you think her biggest challenges would be in the first 100 days in office? Everybody talks about getting off to a fast start when you take that job. What do you think her biggest challenges would be?
So her biggest challenge is obviously going to be, she probably will still have a Republican House. If she has a Democratic Senate, it's going to be by a narrow majority that's not filibuster-proof. So her biggest challenge is going to be, how can she work with Republicans? What are Republicans going to be willing to work with her on? In terms of what she will do uniquely, I don't know how many of you are paying attention. Donald Trump released a child care plan, right? This absolutely comes out of work that Hillary Clinton has been doing since 1997. I was in the archives in Arkansas, and they were developing plans for how you get paid maternity leave, how you get paid leave, right? And the person running that was Neera Tanden, who actually grew up in a family on public assistance, then went into Clinton's administration. She's the president of Center for American Progress now, and she is absolutely in line to be Clinton's chief of staff. So I do think one of the unique things that they've raised to the top of the agenda is women's economic security and ability to balance our jobs and our families. And they're doing it in a way where they're insisting that men be covered also. Because if we want to get to gender equality, we can't just have it, this is the mother's job, this is the parent's job, this is how we have a pro-family democracy in America.
Michelle Obama gave a very powerful speech referring to Donald Trump's tape and the nature of his campaign. And I heard a lot of talk that in some ways, because she's such a good speaker, overshadowed Hillary Clinton. Can you imagine a situation where a few years from now we have Michelle Obama running for president?
That is one prediction I'm not willing to make.
Who's on the horizon as a rising star?
We have it here in California, Kamala Harris. Absolutely. Kirsten Gillibrand on the Republican side, probably Nikki Haley. Some of the ones who might be on the horizon on the Republican side are in tough races right now. We're not sure where they're going to go. But in terms of on the horizon, yes, Michelle might choose to do it. I don't. I have not heard any word of her thinking about running for office. She would certainly be great. But I do think we're going to see some of the younger Democratic women senators like Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Amy Klobuchar putting them.
Would you say there's more significant depth to draw from than there was just a few years ago? There are a number of potential rising stars that are women?
Yes, absolutely.
In both parties?
Absolutely. And, women, it's right. High rates of incumbent reelection in America, that's one of the main reasons we don't have more women in office. There just aren't many offices that are open to run for. So, we started out at like a 90-10 disadvantage and slowly making it. So, yes, we have a bigger bench. Also, the first cohort of women senators and governors, they were breaking glass ceilings there and really focused on doing a really great job in those roles. I think someone like Jennifer Granholm, who was a governor and is a very charismatic speaker, absolutely could have been a great presidential candidate. Unfortunately, she was born in Canada. So,
couple of questions and we'll finish here, Nancy. We've talked a lot about the negative nature of this campaign. And on an optimistic note, I want to come back to one final question, but do you believe that we can get to a place where it isn't so poisonous and toxic in our public discourse because it turns off so many people? It motivates some, but it turns off a lot of people as well.
Mm-hmm.
Can we recover from the nature of this campaign?
I hope so, and I think so. I am seeing a lot of sentiment whenever I talk to young people particularly. They ask me questions like, well, how do we have a genuine conversation about race without everybody getting, their hackles up? We have a problem, but we're going to have to talk about it. I think this is clarifying for political leaders that, if you play with fire, it's going to destroy, consume everything that you care about.
Final question. Do you think, what advice would you give young people in general, but young women in particular, because whether you're a man or a woman, politics is rough business. You got to have a thick skin and it's hard and it's often unpleasant. What advice would you give a young woman who is thinking that political leadership might be something that, and not even necessarily the presidential level,
yeah,
county council, the school board, whatever it is, getting involved in civic responsibility in the political sense. What advice would you give a young person watching what's been happening about what they should do?
I would recommend first that you do a really good assessment of your personality. Personally, I am a writer. I do not sleep well, and I am thin-skinned. So I will not be running for political office.
For you.
Yeah. I would love to write laws, but I know I cannot handle running for office. So are you an extrovert? Do you take, you know, criticism easily? Does it, you know, do you like the competition? If so, then you can run for office. There's lots of jobs behind the scenes. If you're a policy wonk or you like the campaigns or you do social media, there's a tremendous amount of work. What I would recommend is that you have to get involved early, college or right after college, because it's, you know, it's a long road to go through to get to one of these top offices. I would recommend working in a politician's office, you know. A lot of people running,
exposing yourself,
and working on a campaign. I don't think I've done a lot of work in nonprofits. I don't think like, oh, go work in nonprofits and get experience with an issue. You know, that's great. Go do it, but you're going to have to come back into the political arena at, you know, the entry level later.
But if you want to fight for change and follow your passion.
Right, and figure, you know, really be introspective and figure out what best suits your temperament. Do you want to do it in a nonprofit, on an issue, or in the political arena where you can actually write laws and change laws?
Well, I think we can all agree this suits your temperament very well. Our thanks to Nancy L. Cohen, historian and author of the new book, Breakthrough, The Making of America's First President.
Thank you, Dan.
We also thank our listening audience, and we want to remind everyone that copies of Nancy's book are for sale. She'll be glad to sign the book following the program. She was kind to sign mine. I'm Dan Ashley of ABC 7 KGO TV in San Francisco, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are always in the know, is adjourned.